This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. U.S. President Biden says white supremacy is the most lethal threat to his country on the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre. Fear is mounting in the UK over the presence of far-right extremists in the British military. We'll bring you a report from London. And Israel starts the construction process of 350 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. Welcome to the program. U.S. President Joe Biden has declared white supremacy the most lethal threat to his country in the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre. Biden made the remark in an address to the three living survivors of the killing of more than 300 African Americans by white mobs in 1921. He stressed the importance of acknowledging the lives lost in that slaughter, noting that he is the first U.S. president ever to commemorate the event. Biden called for the U.S. to confront its long history of hatred and avoid silence about it. The U.S. president used the occasion to announce his administration's new measures against racial inequality and once again condemned the recent displays of white supremacy across the country. Far-right extremists continue to be inducted into the British military. This week, reports of several serving members of the UK armed forces referred to a controversial anti-extremism scheme that has rekindled fears and reignited calls on the country's Ministry of Defence to increase its auditing and vetting processes.
The UK armed forces' allure for far-right extremists is believed to be as old as British fascism's earliest incarnations. At least 16 members of the country's armed forces investigated over the past 2.5 years have been referred to the UK's so-called PREVENT scheme, a controversial terrorism prevention program.
The British Army is seen as being a defence of Britain and British values, but those British values are rooted in racism, as I say, and also in its history of colonialism and empire. The British military is in itself a racist institution because Britain is a racist society.
The UK Ministry of Defence is yet to release exact figures, but it says the number of investigations in 2020 was less than 10, and those so far this year, less than 5. Critics say, despite the MOD's stated commitment to zero tolerance for far-right extremists, operating within the armed forces, its strong words have not always led to strong action.
Of course, the British government's going to say there's a zero-tolerance policy, but that is nothing in keeping with the reality when it comes to the culture that exists within the British Army, because of its role, because of its history, because of its legacy, and because of its identity. The far right is on the march, not just in the UK, but throughout the West. This is a result of the socio-economic problems ushered in by the 2008 economic collapse, and the far right have been able to point the fingers at migrants and refugees and existing minority communities as being the problem. I think that this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think it goes far, far deeper, and I think there's a cover-up abroad in consequence.
Of the 14 investigations carried out in 2019 into serving armed forces personnel, a staggering 11 stem from far-right concerns. And those concerns have been fueled by images such as this one from 2019. British paratroopers using pictures of former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn for target practice. Or this video from a year earlier of notorious far-right English Defence League founder known as Tommy Robinson, surrounded by a group of young infantrymen.
Last year, the UK's top counter-terrorism officer said the fastest-growing UK terrorist threat came from the far right. A year later, the threat is still there, with critics saying the government is not taking the threat seriously enough. Saeed Fariza, London.
Israel has begun the construction of 350 new settler units near the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. The project is part of plans to expand the El Beit settlement. Several Israeli ministers participated in a ceremony marking the start of the construction. The project was approved by the Israeli cabinet in late 2020. Over 230 settlements have been built since the 1967 occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. All Israeli settlements are deemed illegal under international law. Israel has repeatedly claimed its recent airstrikes on the Gaza Strip targeted resistance groups and military sites. But reports on the ground actually contradict such a claim. Our correspondent in Gaza, Ruba Shabit, for example, has conducted an interview with a survivor of the Israeli attacks who lost 30 members of her family.
After the Israeli airstrike hit Al-Kolak family building in the Gaza Strip, Zainab Al-Kolak was rescued by the civil defense after spending 12 hours under the rubble of her home. Zainab survived, but at least 30 members of her family were killed by the Israeli raid in the latest escalation against Gaza. After repeated failures to extricate her from the rubble, rescue workers finally saved Zainab Al-Kolak, a 22-year-old Palestinian woman who lost her family members in an Israeli airstrike on their house in the Gaza Strip.
We all gathered in a room watching news, and I was using my phone. We heard two missiles hitting somewhere really close. We heard bombing before, but this one was different, and the home was shaking. We got really scared, and we even forgot to take our bags of important things that we prepared for any possible bombing. My mom and my only sister were next to me. The last thing I remember was everyone scared and didn't know what was happening. The roof fell on our heads. In less than a second, I found myself under the rubble.
Stuck under the rubble, Zainab used her cell phone and called the Gaza ambulance service, hoping they could help her and save her family. But it took hours until they saved her from the rubble because Israeli regime destroyed the main roads leading to her home and the hospital.
I was holding my phone while trapped under the rubble. The voices of my mom and sister just disappeared, and I started to call people. I don't know how I remembered the numbers of civil defense. I called them, but they couldn't reach me. I started to call my friends, Shaima and Fatima, but I wasn't able to tell them I was under the rubble. I spent 12 hours there. I just imagined that when I called the civil defense, they would save us fast, but it took long to reach us, and eventually I lost the hope to stay alive.
Zainab, who studies English literature and is interested in arts, expressed that no words can describe her feeling of losing her family. While Zainab's father is still at hospital receiving treatment, Zainab is now worried about her new burdens and responsibilities after losing her mother.
This is not the first time Israel has done such a massacre. We lived our lives just between one war and another. We thought we were safe, but no one is. They hit us with no prior notice. We were a big family, and now I can count us on one hand. I used to be a normal student, and now I have millions of things to take care of as life throws me in the middle of everything.
Zainab and her family members are not the only victims of the Israeli attacks. 11 days of Israeli air, land, and sea assaults on Gaza killed 255 Palestinians, including 66 children. The strikes also wounded more than 1,900 people before a ceasefire went into effect on May the 21st. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
At least 10 people have been killed in three bomb attacks in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. A dozen others were wounded in the explosions. One of the bombs severely damaged an electric network station, causing a blackout in the city. No group has claimed responsibility for the attacks. Afghanistan's seen rising levels of violence over the past few months. The situation has gotten especially worse since Washington reneged on its agreements to withdraw all its troops from the country by May the 1st. Now, Iran's envoy to the International Atomic Energy Agency says the agency's latest report confirms that Tehran is implementing the country's strategic parliamentary law. That law limits IAEA's access and obliges Iran's Atomic Energy Organization to press ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities that go over and beyond Iran's commitments under the nuclear deal. From Vienna, here's Homolesky with a report.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's latest report on Iran is the first since the country stopped implementing voluntary transparency measures as a result of a law passed by Parliament restricting agency access to nuclear facilities. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the IAEA valid until the 24th of June, the agency will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Iran's envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said the agency had no access that had previously been provided under the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA.
The verification and monitoring activities that the agency had in our nuclear facilities based on the JCPOA, as the Director General reflected in his report, actually all those areas have been stopped and the agency didn't have any kind of access in accordance with the JCPOA to our nuclear sites and also the nuclear activities in the nuclear facilities.
In his report, IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi estimated Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium to be about 16 times higher than the limit set in the deal. Gharibabadi said Iran is continuing to enrich uranium at the level of 5, 20 and 60%. The limit set in the deal was 3.67%.
There is no suspension in the nuclear activities, such as installation of production, installation of new machines, and also the enrichment level and the stockpile. So it is very important that actually these kind of activities have not been affected even due to the nuclear negotiation that we have around the JCPOA in Vienna nowadays.
Iran stepped back from its nuclear commitments in response to the previous U.S. administration's withdrawal from the deal and the reimposition of sanctions.
Negotiations to revive the deal have been taking place in Vienna since April, with Tehran standing firm on its position. It will only return to full compliance after the U.S. has removed all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Homolizki, Vienna.
India reports nearly 133,000 new coronavirus infections and more than 3,200 deaths in the past 24 hours. The country's total number of infections now stands at 28.3 million. India's overall deaths also tops 335,000 Daily deaths across the South Asian nation have seen a sharp decrease from their peak of over 4,000 last month. India's daily infections have also declined in the past week. India has been battling a second wave of COVID-19 for weeks now. It is the world's second worst hit nation in terms of cases after the U.S.
After months of despair and a battle against the COVID-19 pandemic, a ray of hope has emerged in several parts of Indian subcontinent as the second wave of the pandemic is showing signs of retreat. The new cases continue to fall for the fourth consecutive day, based on government figures. Health experts and surveys, however, suggest the figures could be 20 times higher than the official figures.
We were overwhelmed by the daily number of cremations till last week, and most of the time there was hardly any calculation. Now it seems there is a slight drop in cases. I hope things are changing now. We pray to God we never get to see such scenes again.
According to a latest study carried out by scientists at the University of Michigan, along with scholars from several institutes, the estimated COVID cases in India could be as high as 492 million till mid-May, which contradicts the Indian official figures of 24 million. The study also puts the overall death toll 4.5 times more than what is officially recorded.
We were struggling last week with the number of patients and dead bodies, and I'm sure there is no proper data about the number of deaths since India is a big country. Cities might have calculations, but there is no calculation about villages.
Many parts of the country have now started gradually opening after weeks of strict lockdowns, which has put a tremendous toll on the country's economic activity. Officials, however, have warned the pandemic is not over, urging people to follow the COVID protocol strictly. Lockdowns aimed at containing the pandemic have now inflicted a heavy toll on the country's economy. Reports suggest the South Asian nation could be headed for a double-digit unemployment rate in the coming weeks, and migrant workers are among the hardest hit. According to official figures, India has registered 28 million COVID cases so far, 25 million have recovered, and about 330,000 have died due to the pandemic. Now the country is battling acute vaccination shortage, while it aims to vaccinate 10 million adults per day from mid-July. Biggest vaccine makers have already started bidding for the contracts after states were directed to buy vaccines directly from the manufacturers. Health experts say it is a mammoth task given the country's geography and the population. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Australia's Victoria State extends a COVID-19 lockdown in its capital city of Melbourne for a second week to contain an outbreak of the Indian variant of the virus. Melbourne's 5 million residents are only allowed to leave home for essential work, shopping, and healthcare issues. Six new locally acquired cases were reported in Melbourne on Wednesday, taking the total infections in the latest outbreak to 60. Australia's second most populous state entered a lockdown last Thursday after detecting its first locally transmitted infection in 3 months. Elsewhere, the virus surge in South America has also raised concerns. The World Health Organization has warned that outbreaks in the already hard-hit region are once again worsening.
The situation in South America right now remains of very high concern. 8 out of the top 10 countries reporting the highest mortality rates per population in the last week have been from the region of the Americas.
Ryan says the disease transmission in the region is intense and healthcare systems are under pressure. His comments came after Peru more than doubled its official coronavirus death toll to over 180,000. Peru is now the country with the highest COVID mortality per capita worldwide. Brazil also remains the world's second worst hit nation in terms of deaths and nearly 463,000 fatalities. And that's it with international news.
diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
the 13th presidential election. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on June 18th. Article 6 of the Islamic Republic of Iran's constitution says that the affairs of the country are administered through elections relying on public votes. There is no compulsion in Iran for voting, but the average rate of participation in various elections has been over 50% since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The Iranian people within the framework of the constitution choose their representatives in the assembly of experts. They choose the members of parliament too. Moreover, they choose the members of the city and village Islamic councils. However, the presidential election has a special status for them as they chose a person to take the helms of the executive branch of the state for 4 years. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, considers maximum participation in elections as the symbol of freedom of people in determining their fate, saying, "When you choose a president, it means that you are giving all the main executive authorities of the country to a person who is your elect and stems from your votes and will. This means the people's power to administer the country and to have the fate of the nation by the nation. This is not a trivial and a small matter. This is everything for us. This presence has been considered as a trench for our country. This is a very important thing. If there had been no election, popular rule, popular presence, and the gushing wills of you people in the middle of the scene and field, be sure that this revolution would have not lasted even for a single year. It would not have been able to stand against any of the political assaults and economic sieges of governments. You have been that main trench. Election is a symbol of people's presence, just as the presence in the demonstration of 22nd of Bahman, February 11th, is one of the symbols of popular presence. The enemy and the arrogant apparatuses are scared of your election and demonstration on 22nd of Bahman. Therefore, they make use of their forces so that they may be able to take election, popular presence, free vote, and popular involvement in their own fate from this country." Dear listeners, 38 elections have been held in Iran for the past 42 years. The rate of participation has been from 62 to 88 on these years. The highest participation was in 2009 presidential election. University professor Dr. Hanizadeh says, "The Islamic Republic of Iran, as the first model of religious popular rule in the world, attaches a high importance to people's vote, and in fact, people played a key role in the political structure of power in the Islamic Republic of Iran system. The continuation of the Islamic system is indeed related to people's presence in various elections, and the basic principle is people's turnout in elections. Thus, in every election, people are the ones who decide on who takes the helms of power regardless of their political inclinations. Article 116 of the Constitution makes it clear that the presidential candidates should announce their readiness officially before the start of the election. the manner of holding the presidential election is determined by the law. This year, due to the coronavirus restrictions, there will be special preparations for holding presidential election. The number of ballot boxes will be increased and the time of voting will be extended for a few more hours. According to the law, the time span for election both inside the country and abroad is 10 hours, which can be extended if necessary. Ayatollah Khamenei says on the importance of the presidential election, "Election is a one-day event. It takes place in one day, but it is among the events that have long-standing impact. You hold the presidential election in one day, but firstly, you cause a person or some persons to rule the fate of the country and major currents of the country for 4 years. Secondly, the range of its impact will not be restricted to only those 4 years. Sometimes, governments do things whose impacts remain for years, whether good works or, God forbid, bad works. Its impact will not be limited to those 4 years. It will continue like a current. Therefore, you do something in a day, you make a choice, take a measure whose impact will persist in short term for 4 years, and in long term, sometimes for 40 years. Election is this much important."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. To swim in the murky waters of the North Sea, where lie the remnants of 5 centuries of naval battles.
I found this submerged world even more fascinating as it was hidden. Through diving, I understood the extent of the military debris left behind by the 20th century. Because in the North Sea and the Baltic Sea, the Allies deliberately sunk ships transporting hundreds of millions of tons of chemical weapons. Today, we are holding more and more commemorations for both world wars, while under the sea, the metallic fuselages holding these substances are corroding. If we don't take action, scientists predict an unprecedented catastrophe.
The munitions are silent killers that are basically the chemical releases from them are drifting in the ocean as we speak today.
Why were these chemical weapons dumped in the sea? What action can we take to protect man and the environment before it's too late? Because this dreadful legacy is ready to resurface as if the salt water was preventing history's scars to heal.
Part 3.
At the start of the 20th century, the North Sea is the confrontation site for the industrial nations. France, the Netherlands, the UK, Belgium, and Germany battle over commercial and political geoeconomics. Europe's first industrial war sees the development of new weapons, like the submarine, the airplane, tanks, and deadly chemical weapons. All North Sea and Baltic coasts are affected, and new sites appear. In the North Sea, over 50 sites are identified. This figure doesn't include many forgotten cases of dumping, so it's impossible to make a precise list of all the dumping sites. In order to help the fishermen, the Royal Danish Navy mission is to decontaminate ships polluted by gas. A bomb disposal unit is permanently ready to intervene in the zone.
On our ChemSea program, the search and assessment of chemical weapons, we investigated the codfish in munition sites and outside munition sites. In the munition sites, we actually found tumors in the codfish, stress on their kidneys and livers, extraprudential fish diseases. But the most alarming thing we found were the juvenile fish, their inability to reproduce. We're actually investigating Bellhorn now. We're taking fish samples, and some of these samples we have found are positive.
So if you expose the muscles to these compounds, they take it up, and they take it up in relation to the concentration you expose them to, and they show even on the lower concentration, on the lowest concentration, they show already effects. There's one thing now to investigate how many or how high the concentration of a compound deriving from a warfare agent is in the organism you intend to consume, for example, so in the flesh of the fish or in the entire muscles. That's one thing, and you can debate about any limits now, which are allowed and which are maybe not really harming the consumer or not. However, there is, for me personally, there's only a general question. Do we accept that there are traces of damned ammunitions made to kill humans in your food?
What we know from the sediments and the water is that in all areas where ammunitions was dumped, you can find the substances leaking from the corroding munitions in the sediment and also in the deep waters. So there is a risk, really, that marine life takes up the substances in their natural habitat. After having studied this issue now for many years, we consider this to be a real ecological time bomb.
How do you explain that Germany and Belgium, with poor military budgets, have been working on solutions since 1980, while France is doing nothing? Domestic defense has the vast sum of 34.2 billion euros at its disposal, the equivalent of the Russian army, the second military force on the planet. Postponed until later. France has been doing that for over 20 years. Thus, the French chemical weapons were first of all stored in open air in a field in Vimy, in the Pas de Calais, regardless of the minimal security rules of the local population. But accidents, explosions, and leaks of toxic substances put pressure on army ministries to move the ammunition at the discretion of a military site. The shells were moved to the Suippes base in Ubes. This camp had already housed part of the nuclear strike force. It was in the Pluton silos of the Hades missiles, as in the gods of hell in Greek mythology, where they were stored. The French army were the only ones not to give me authorization to film, and I couldn't film the camp. But 10 years ago, I'd filmed the same kind of half-buried silos in the north of the U.S. One century after the end of World War I, historic ammunition is rotting in the alveoli of old nuclear sites. It raises questions on the future of ammunition manufactured by the Directorate General of Armaments, because if France is incapable, for solely political reasons, of taking charge of 100-year-old weapons, what has it done with its obsolete major nuclear arsenal? France's chosen technology to destroy its land-based chemical arsenal will be operated by a dismantling program called Sequoia. Sequoia is not a new witticism from Michel Sapin. It's a military factory under construction in Ubes that I was not authorized to film. These refusals emanate from one of France's most opaque structures, the Director General of Armaments. The DGA entrusted construction to an industrial military group that was rapidly sued for insider influence and bribery. The Sequoia project, 20 years after its launch, is still not operational. To put a stop to submerging this ammunition in the sea, the Belgian army built a dismantling center at Poelcapelle, in operation for over 20 years, despite a restricted military budget. Bomb disposal experts deal with shells from Flanders fields daily. The center has a solution for treating the abundant land-based ammunition. Could it take charge of the 35,000 tons of weapons submerged at Naka?
At this moment in Poelcapelle, every day munition, chemical munition from Flanders fields is brought in. What if you come up with thousands, tens of thousands of shells at the same time from the Paardenmarkt site that are corroding all of a sudden very fast because you put them in the air, so there's a lot of oxygen around?
I strongly believe that if we don't clean up the munitions, the ocean will die. It's just a matter of time. What we need to do now is we need to develop an international treaty, an international trust fund to address the site. We can clean this up.
My investigation leads me back to Germany, where it all began. The Munster Camp, an epicenter of the German chemical program during World War I and World War II, is located in the heart of a dense forest and still heavily contaminated. Early 20th century, this camp was pioneering in the design of chemical weapons. Today, it is the European leader in decontamination techniques. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons uses German know-how to destroy mustard gas, chlorine, and the sarin gas. Perhaps one day, this center will destroy the ammunition that is submerged close to the German North Sea and Baltic coasts. For the moment, the solutions mostly concern weapons found on the ground. The issue of submerged ammunition and the damage it causes is still pending.
What we need to do is remove this from the military and establish civilian authority boards that can manage a cleanup, manage a solution to doing something about these munitions. As long as the military has them, they will determine, do I buy a tank, a plane, or a ship, or do I clean up a munition site? What do you think the answer is?
Since 1997 in Germany, a public company is responsible for dismantling and decontaminating on behalf of the Federal Ministry of Defense. The metallic residue that survives the destruction of the chemical elements is reduced to scrap and poured into containers. These small pieces of metal will be recycled for undercarriages for children's bikes, or will perhaps be turned back into shells for the tanks that I can hear in training. Thousand years ago, the North Sea didn't exist, and a vast forest connected France to England. At the end of my filming, I met a Dutch fisherman who pulls out mammoth bones in his net, mixed with shells from both world wars. This discovery made me realize the lifespan of our population, these traces that we leave behind. These fossils came from a time when the North Sea didn't exist, while chemical weapons will probably poison the sea for centuries to come. What will remain of our civilization other than this waste? The sea is a world where everything is murky. Even our past becomes an oversight there. The dumping sites were forgotten willingly or through negligence. Even if oversight represents the biggest danger, today the sea where life came from is threatened by a time bomb that may destroy the fundamental things that populate it.
the limelight.
China opened its first 5G-enabled fully automated port a year ago in Shenzhen, with automated cranes stacking containers on driverless trucks. Shanghai's Yangshan port began fully automated 24-hour operations in August of 2020. In late 2020, Shandong Energy Group began operations as an automated coal mine controlled by a 5G network. We have prepared for you an article written by David Goldman. The piece is titled US is Chasing China's Tail on 5G. The article has been published by the Asia Times. According to China's industry leaders, the mainland's manufacturers have installed about 5,000 private fifth-generation networks and will add tens of thousands more this year as 5G broadband enables fourth industrial revolution applications. China already has 70% of the world's installed fifth-generation base stations and 80% of the world's 5G smartphone users. The global chip shortage and U.S. sanctions against Chinese telecommunications equipment firms such as Huawei and ZTE have slowed China's fifth-generation build-out to some extent, but fifth-generation infrastructure already covers all of China's major cities. According to industry sources, China will add between 500,000 to 800,000 new 5G base stations to the 792,000 in place at the end of February. 5G's impact on productivity as well as profitability will come from downstream applications, not the network build-out as such. One Chinese executive told Asia Times, "It doesn't make any sense for the West to pour billions of dollars into alternatives to China's fifth-generation technology," adding, "It's too little too late, and it focuses on the wrong areas. Trying to invent an alternative ecosystem isn't going to work. I would have expected the United States to say, let's transform industry, let's be more competitive. As I argued in my 2020 book, You Will Be Assimilated, China's Plan to Sinoform the World, fifth generation is the railroad of the 21st century. A carrier technology whose importance lies in the other technologies it makes possible." Every important railroad company founded in the 19th century went bankrupt, and the industry was unprofitable until Edward Henry Harriman, an American financier and railroad executive, reorganized the Union Pacific at the end of the century. But it launched America's industrial and agricultural revolutions. According to a semiconductor industrial executive, the speed of further fifth-generation build-out will depend in part on China's ability to manufacture chips with transistor gateways of 28 nanometers or less. Most observers believe that China has mastered 28 nanometer process node production and will be able to fabricate most of its own requirements by the end of 2021. Media attention has focused on the newest chips with gateways of 7 nanometers or even less, with power high-end smartphones, crypto mining workstations, and other high-powered devices. But the workhorse of semiconductor applications is the previous generation of chips in the 14 to 28 nanometer range, which will provide the bulk of the chip demand during the next 5 years, especially for wireless connectivity. In its drive for semiconductor self-sufficiency, China has concentrated on fabrication capacity and chip-making equipment in the 28-nanometer range. Shanghai Microelectronic Equipment will deliver the first Chinese-made lithography scanner using the deep ultraviolet DUV process in late 2021. Washington persuaded the Dutch government to stop the Netherlands firm ASML from selling China the extreme ultraviolet scanners required for 7-nanometer and smaller chip production. Only Taiwan and South Korea have the ability to make the narrower gateway chips. But China has been an important buyer of Dutch DUV machines and appears ready to deploy its own. Although U.S. carriers offer what they call fifth-generation service, the American version provides download speeds barely above the older generation 4G LTE broadband and around 60 megabits per second. The average speed in China is 5 times higher at over 300 megabits per second. Private networks support industrial robotics as well as smart logistics, including automation of major ports. A fifth-generation network supports the automation of the Shanghai port, which handles 44 million containers per year, compared to 8 million containers at America's largest facility in Long Beach, California, where more than 20 ships are waiting offshore to unload. China opened its first fifth-generation enabled fully automated port a year ago in Xiamen, with automated cranes stacking containers on driverless trucks. Shanghai's Yangshan port began fully automated 24-hour operations in August of 2020. In late 2020, Shandong Energy Group began operations at an automated coal mine controlled by a fifth-generation network. Automated warehouses, autonomous vehicles, and drones promise to transform e-commerce, with firms like Alibaba and JD Logistics offering same or next-day delivery from computer-controlled storage facilities where packages are sorted and sent by drones or autonomous vehicles. JD Logistics' $3.2 billion initial public offering launched in Hong Kong recently, promising a new level of productivity in delivery. JD Logistics still depends on 200,000 delivery personnel, but its warehouse management makes Amazon look primitive. According to a 2020 report by the Cape Gemini Research Institute, by contrast, Western companies are still evaluating whether they should install private fifth-generation networks to support factory automation. Some German companies, including Audi and BASF, are testing private networks. In May of 2021, Ericsson installed a private network for Airbus, Europe's premier manufacturer of civilian aircraft, but the network will run on fourth generation until the fifth generation network is launched next year. In Silicon Valley, Hitachi and Ericsson have built a fifth generation research network. With few exceptions, Western investment in enterprise fifth generation networks is tentative and experimental, while China's factories, mines, and ports have put fifth generation into full operation. The critical difference between fifth generation and older broadband isn't speed, but rather carrying capacity and latency or speed of response. Industrial operations require near instant response time among machines controlled by the network, and fifth generation, which reduces response time by a factor of 10, opens up possibilities for industrial automation that formerly were unimaginable. In 2019, I interviewed Huawei Chief Technology Officer Paul Scanlon for my book on China. Scanlon told me the combination of machine learning and fifth generation will allow robots to talk to each other and work out production processes without the help of human engineers. Paul Scanlon told me, let's take robotics today. Fifth generation changes everything. Typically, 5G is spoken about in terms of download speed, but that's not the most important advantage. He added, for industrial processes, autonomous vehicles and other applications, the latency, the time it takes for one device to acquire and respond to a signal from another device, is more important. On a factory floor today, robot A does its instruction, passes the bit to robot B, and it's the same thing. Paul Scanlon added, now if we put very low latency inside each of the robots, and they can be robots from different manufacturers, and put them in a room and give them the rules,